I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Doug Gann. He's a preservation archaeologist with the Center for Desert Archaeology, and he's going to be giving a talk called Archaeological Virtual Reality, Building the True Digital Museum. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So, virtual reality, what does this have to do with archaeology?
Well, at first you would think not a whole lot, but the virtual reality tools that are out on the market and available for us today, it's all basically about serving and sharing three-dimensional representations of spaces, places, or objects. And that's done on you know, the old high school Cartesian XYZ grid. And it's kind of a natural for archaeology because everything that's excavated is also excavated on an XYZ grid. We might call it northing, easting, and elevation instead of X, Y, and Z, but the data is directly transferable. And so it provides a really interesting and quick way of taking archaeological data and converting it into something that the public can immediately understand.
So when you do that, you are filling in the blanks to some extent. So let's say you excavate a broken wall and some broken pots. Are you making them whole?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Usually I try to make them whole again. And that just, it makes for a much more compelling and interesting visualization.
When you do this, so what is the relationship between you doing virtual reality and the archaeologist who's digging in the dirt?
Up until about 10 years ago, I was one and the same. And I've since really specialized in moving more to the desktop. So I generally, if I'm going to reconstruct a site, I need to go to that site and get a feel for the place, for lack of a better word, take photographs of everything I possibly can, and then start drilling down into the archaeological research, be that a published report or unpublished reports, or best yet, getting a chance to sit down and talk with the people who actually dug the deposits, because they're the ones that are going to have the best idea as to what various aspects of the site would look like.
So when you are engaged in this, as more evidence changes, then your virtual representation changes.
Yeah, and that's really one of the neat things about using archaeological virtual reality is you can establish a model as a sort of virtual hypothesis, and as new information comes in, you can change the model to reflect new data. And we had a project in Tucson where we were trying to reconstruct one of the original Spanish colonial structures in town. And it had existed as a standing building up until about 1900. And Adobe buildings do, it just sort of melted away through time. But we went to excavate the site and found that it had been turned into a garbage dump and there was nothing left. And so all we had left were archaeological maps that had been drawn in the 1950s and about 40 historic photographs. And so I built a model based on that data, and then we went to the press and said, hey, you know, if anybody else knows of photos from this particular time period of this building, please let us know. And sure enough, a couple of really critical photos showed up that let us sort of finish the model of the building and either confirmed or discounted a couple of the architectural details.
When I was looking at the site that had some of these walkthroughs and kind of, I guess you call them virtual representations of these actual places, it felt like a video game.
That's an excellent point. And that really is kind of the key to the central point of my talk is those things that you saw online up until now, we build these virtual models and we put a virtual camera inside the virtual model and we render out an animation that shows people what this place might have looked like based on our best theories. It's time to change that, and the way that we're going to change that is through game engines, actually, employing game engines to take out the weapons, take out the sort of more appalling elements, and start repurposing these tools for educational modules, for lack of a better word.
Can you do it so that it ends up being actual photography instead of animation that's used?
That's easily done right now through a program called Photosynth, and if you've not seen it, you can go to www.photosynth.net, and that uses that serves photographs in a three-dimensional virtual reality sort of context. So you sort of surf through photographs, and the way the program works is you just feed it as many digital photographs as you can of a place, and it will create a 3D model based on those photographs and let you wander through the photos, not really the model so much.
So you could take, in theory, for example, some of those architectural photographs that are black and white, restore them, put them in color somehow, colorize them a la Ted Turner, and have a almost realistic representation.
That gets a little trickier in terms of when you're working with historic photographs, it's all a question of accuracy. And if you don't know the shape of the lens that the photograph was taken through, you can't do a whole lot that's super accurate with these sort of techniques. On that project where we used the historic photographs on the historic mission, we could get accuracy to about a foot in either direction for a structure that was 100 feet by 40 feet by 30 feet. But most people, when they're dealing with archaeological data, want accuracy at least to the centimeter, if not the millimeter.
There's an interest. I mean, what you just said, you used to be a digging in the dirt archaeologist. Now you're a desktop archaeologist. Those are really not only different skill sets, but almost different personalities of the academic or of the scientist.
It was a graduate school was an interesting time, trying to get a traditional degree in archaeology and trying to stay pace with 3D technology, which is changing so fast. But I would like to throw in, the center's mission really is archaeological preservation, and it's our position that it's kind of time to stop digging. We've dug enough. The museums are full. I'd like to see a 10-year moratorium on excavations and just send people back into the museums to do the analysis that hasn't been done to inform us about even the right questions to be asking of the archaeological record. And sure, sites are going to be threatened, highways are going to come through, and that archaeology, I'm not saying that archaeology shouldn't be done, but it really is time for archaeologists in general in the Southwest to take a step back, go back into the museums, and look at the collections again. Everybody loves to dig. Digging is so much fun. But for every hour you spend digging, you need to spend 10 hours in the lab analyzing. And I'd say we've spent an hour digging and an hour analyzing in total.
So you're painting a picture in which there are museums full of carefully labeled, unanalyzed archives of material from various sites.
It may not even be necessarily unanalyzed. It's just that the analysis techniques have changed so much in the past 10 to 15 years. There's so many new things that we could be doing, so many new types of analysis, so many new types of chemical composition tests. There's all manner of things.
Tell us more. I mean, what kinds of new analysis do you have?
Well, neutron activation has been around for at least 10 or 15 years now, but that's a way of going and finding the exact source materials from which a given pot would have been constructed from. So you know what clay bed the pot comes from, or you know the geological properties. An analysis called petrofaces analysis, where you look at the temper inside the clay to see where the sand grains, to look at the shape of the sand grains. Then you go out and you find the parent beds of those sands, so you know a whole lot more about where that pottery was being produced and the economics of pottery production, for instance. There's a new analysis called ostracod analysis, which is these tiny little microscopic shrimp that live in all fresh water. And there's probably 200 different species of ostracods, but from a soil sample from a given site, if there's water or canals involved in any way, these fossils serve as indexes to how clear the water was, how fast the water was running, the temperature of the water. And that can just tell you all sorts of things about prehistoric agriculture, for instance. And it's these types of studies that the center is really interested in sponsoring to really go back and make better use of what's already been excavated.
So that's what the center for your Center for Desert Archaeology is all about.
Pretty much. One of the ways that we do this is we have what we call preservation fellows, where we hire promising graduate students who are interested in similar topics. And we do occasionally conduct limited excavations, but that usually means rather than digging 30 rooms out of a Pueblo site, it may be one by 1 meter square through a trash mound so that we can get a stratigraphic sequence of the pottery involved and then run all these really interesting tests on the pottery. But it's a very different sort of philosophy about digging than I grew up with.
We're talking to Doug Gann about preservation archaeology and virtual reality. I was thinking as I was watching these virtual reality little samples that are on your site of a program that I did with a young man who made a documentary about video games a couple of years ago, and one of the things that became so clear is that there is this tremendous untapped potential for intelligent, interesting, and truly educational video games, and the few that there are can educate kids in a really hands-on way about ancient Greece or about whatever the subject is that they take on. And as I was watching yours, I mean, there could be, in theory, some kind of really interesting virtual reality archaeology video games.
Absolutely, and that's basically one of my upcoming assignments is to really take apart and learn how to use the mechanics of what's happening behind the scenes in games. It's called a game engine, and it's what handles all of the three-dimensional, you know, all the three-dimensional reality aspects of what the end user is seeing. And there's been so many new breakthroughs in this realm. I just can't wait. I don't know if you're familiar with the Xbox's Kinetic system, but it's a device that you plug into a video game console like an Xbox, and it senses your presence. So it senses the gestures you make. It knows where your face is. And I'm toying with trying to create museum exhibits that, you know, everybody's familiar with touchscreen museum exhibits. I would like to get rid of the touchscreen, project the exhibit on a three-dimensional surface, and let the users just by gesturing manipulate the environment that they're exploring. And we've just recently received a grant from the National Science Foundation that we hope to employ to do just that.
Very, very interesting. It's also, I mean, when you think about it, the people who are going to be the next generation of museum goers are virtually all going to be people who grew up playing video games in the first place.
Well, and part of the problem with that is that children and teenagers these days are incredibly sophisticated consumers of digital media. And so the stuff that I've been creating that I think is so cool and so neat, kids look at it and like, wow, that's not even close to what last year's Xbox could do.
Right.
And that's sort of a humbling, it's a humbling state where you realize you still have a lot to learn.
Will you, because of that, start working with basically professional game developers?
I'm working with tools that sort of bridge the gap between 3D modelers and game developers. And to really be a professional game developer, I would simply hire them. It requires knowledge of programming languages that are a little above and beyond my level of skill. But I can develop prototypes in these types of softwares that bridge the gap between true game designers and the 3D modelers, and we'll see what happens.
How is the non-technically oriented, the more digger kind of archaeological community responding to the kind of work you do? Has it really penetrated?
A lot of people see it as a fun way of sharing their work. And however, there's still a few holy grails out there that we're trying to reach in terms of ways that we could use these models that would help archaeology. And in an upcoming project, I'm planning to take data from about 30 years of excavations from the University of Arizona's Archaeological Field School at a place called Grasshopper Pueblo and try to actually model not a reconstruction of the site so much as a digital representation of all of the deposits that were excavated, because it's not the artifacts that are really important. It's the deposits and how those deposits were created and what those deposits contain that really tell us stuff about behaviors in the past.
What do you mean by deposits?
Let's say you're digging through a trash midden and you find a layer of soil that obviously indicates someone took a basket full of hot ashes and garbage from a room and dumped it. That is a specific deposit that relates to a specific event in the past, and it's those sorts of things that allow us to start building inferences about what actually happened. And just in the ways that trash is deposited, you can learn an awful lot.
When you learn all these things about a site, what does that, I mean, I don't know how to ask this exactly, but what is the usefulness of that information?
That's a tough question. It shouldn't be tough, but for people that are interested in understanding, for me, I'll take a step back here. For me, I would like to be able to create a resource by which people could visualize the past in most places in the Southwest, to look back through time at where they're at right now. So this hypothetical system, you could be standing on a corner in Santa Fe and with your phone dial back to the first Palace of the Governors, and then dial back to the Pueblo underneath, and then dial back to the archaic populations who once inhabited this valley. I think if people could understand their place in literally a 13,000-year continuum of human history and time and space, they couldn't help but be better stewards of it. So that's sort of my big picture goal.
In the work that you've actually done talking about stewardship, where have you seen people being better and worse stewards of places in the Southwest?
Well, Tucson's, I've spent a lot of time working in Tucson, and Tucson started out with being terrible stewards. They turned the birthplace of the community into a garbage dump. They had a systematic campaign to erase all traces of Mexican-American heritage from the town from 1880 to about 1970. And it's only now that people are suddenly realizing how boneheaded that campaign was, and how Tucson in many ways ripped its own heart and soul out. So we're starting to see people suddenly realizing that the place they live in did have a really interesting, long colonial history, that Tucson existed that Tucson's basically existed for at least 4,000 years. And so that's starting to help establish a sense of pride of place.
What about the indigenous sites that you've worked with? I guess what I'm sort of wondering about is there's a kind of mythology of Native people being wonderful stewards of the earth, but then reality turns out some are better than others. It's not just us who've kind of messed things up.
People are people, and people make mistakes all over the place, and people have successes all over the place. And I think one of the things that I really hope we can do more of in the future is to be working with these technologies with Native American groups to help them share their past. I'm working on a really interesting project with the site I did my doctoral research on, and this isn't as much virtual museum stuff as podcasts, but we did a really neat podcast where we had Hopi elders and Hopi music and Hopi narrators taking the public on tours through this ancient Hopi village. And week after next, I'll be finishing the recording of the Hopi language version of that podcast. And that, I hope, is going to at least help with helping teach younger Hopi students their own language.
Tell us about some of the sites that you have excavated and just some of the actual, who was there, what they did, what you know about them.
Okay. I actually got started, I'm from Tucson, but I got started doing historic archaeology, so I worked at the Saratoga Battlefield, which was a very interesting experience. And some of the evidence there was some of the most grisly, gruesome burial data you could possibly imagine. And
skeletons, that kind of stuff.
What people did to the skeletons, this wasn't stuff that we were excavating, but they had collections of really just absolutely brutal stuff that the Patriots had inflicted on the Loyalists, and that was rather frightening. When I got back to the Southwest, I worked at a place called Homolity, which is around Winslow, Arizona, and it was a series of ancestral Pueblo Hope. Ancestral Hopi Pueblos, and that was through a project that was run through the Arizona State Museum, but funded through Earthwatch, and so it was an amazing time, is the only way to describe it. I worked there for about 14 summers, And it was a continual mix of interested people from the general public who would come and pay so many hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars to come and work with the project for 2 to 3 weeks. We always had a crew of Hopi students working with us, and we were working under Dr. Charles Adams from the Arizona State Museum. And we learned so much about life during this particular time period, and it was a very, very fascinating research project.
How, when you look at how people were living during that time period and how Hopis in the same area are living now, what are the continuities? What are the discontinuities?
At Homolivi, I see a direct, unbroken link between the way Hopi is living now to the way Hopi was living in the 13th, 14th centuries. That's just absolutely unbroken, and just some of the most amazing moments. One year I was working outside the edge of a pueblo, just peeling off surface after surface that had been built up against the side of the village, and I encountered a set of symbols that had been carved into the ground. And we had Hopi elders tour and get a chance to see them, and this one old man's eyes lit up, and he said, "I know that. I know what that means. I can't tell you, but I know exactly what that means." And for me, that was the power of archaeology for good, that it provided these people with a direct tie to their past, and that their systems of symbology are still intact, and it established a level of meaning for them that was deeply meaningful. You know, it's a little bit frustrating that you can't know, but you have to acknowledge that there's certain types of knowledge that you're just never going to never have access to, and be okay with that.
We're talking to Doug Gann from the Center for Desert Archaeology. So you talked at the beginning about it would be nice to have like a 10-year moratorium on digging. We have on this program at other times talked to archaeologists who are envisioning a future in which there will be less digging, not only for the reasons that you're saying, but because there are tools that will be able to look under the ground without actually having to dig it up. Is that where are we with that?
That's the other half of preservation archaeology I should have probably mentioned earlier. We are very much in support of those types of studies, absolutely. However, in terms of just the physics involved, looking under the ground is probably one of the most difficult problems imaginable. And the Army has funded millions of dollars worth of research into trying to simply find buried caves, for obvious reasons, in Afghanistan. And they're not having much luck. There are some new technologies involving backscatter X-rays, which deal with some pretty high energy physics, shooting X-rays into the ground and seeing what gets reflected out. That might have some utility in the near future. And then there's ground-penetrating radar and soil electrical resistivity. And these are techniques that are very useful when they work, but there's all sorts of things that can cause them not to work. And so they're sort of hit and miss.
One of the things I was thinking about in imagining a digital museum was there is still something, I think, important about seeing the texture of the art, even though you can't touch them, seeing the texture of the artifacts and the smoothness or roughness of the bowls and all those kinds of things. That's what we go to museums for.
And that's a really big challenge for what I'm doing. But every year, the tools for representing these things on the video screens becomes easier to use, becomes a little bit cheaper, a little bit faster, and a little bit more realistic. So we keep trying to build toward these levels of realism. I think we're about to start seeing another major change in the way that things like television are served in our houses. The electronics industry sold a lot of products to consumers with these new great big screens, and then that market got saturated. So now they're trying to sell 3D screens, which frankly I don't think is going to work. I don't see that as a very viable technology. But there's a move afoot to change the display rates that our monitors are displaying, so that in effect they start pumping 3 to 4 times more visual information on top of the HD signal that's already coming into people's homes. that's going to make things seem so much more real and so much more lifelike. It'll be a step towards being able to share things like the glossiness or roughness of textures. But ultimately, everybody knows there's no substitute for going and seeing the real thing.
So maybe it'll be kind of the best of both worlds. I mean, we'll be able to walk through a pueblo and also see still artifacts in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Well, Doug Gann is a preservation archaeologist with the Center for Desert Archaeology, which is on the web at cdarc.org. Thanks for being with us.
Not a problem. Thank you.